Friday, September the 23rd, began a little after 6 in Tony's house in Santa Fe. Mm-hmm. Carried away with the feeling of how bright and beautiful the garden was and how much we'd love to share it. Late the night before, Tony had asked all the newspaper women to come out and have coffee and sweet rolls at 7 the next morning. Right. It was 10 o'clock, but Tony said, "Never fear, Poldo here is a can-do man," as the president would say. Poldo grinned. And somehow a bakery opened, and the delicious rolls and hot coffee were waiting for us in the garden at 7 o'clock, as most of my weary fellow travelers straggled in. The garden was enchanting. The first thing that struck you were four enormous, brilliant red strings of chili peppers, about 4 feet long, hanging on the columns of the portal. The tuberous begonias were bright reds and pinks and yellows in their Mexican pots. And there was a great olla full of chamisa, the wild golden shrub that blooms this time of year. The marigolds and zinnias were a riot of color, and there was a tiny bit of pepper plants that grew from seeds which Tony said he had picked in the Garden of Gethsemane. The guests were delighted with the portal and the little corner fireplace and the orangery, which is really a small greenhouse with a sitting room attached. And they saw a few of his things from the brick house, the table made from an old walnut tree that grew on the place, and some of Mother's old silver. But our unflagging sergeant, Liz, had us in the cars a little before 8, me riding with you dolls, headed for San Ildefonso Indian Pueblo, Stu briefing me along the way. It's a small village of adobe houses, growing, and that really is the word, around a dusty plaza with one huge cottonwood tree in it, where about 300 Indians live. The leader, whose title is governor, was Gilbert Atencio, a fine-looking man who was on hand to meet me and to introduce governors from other surrounding pueblos along the Rio Grande. San Ildefonso, I heard, dates from the 14th century, and only 10 miles away is Los Alamos. What a span of history. We went into one home where little Head Start children were being fed their meal, bright-eyed, solemn, quite silent. We saw a dance by the women in costumes, with which they welcomed the spring. We went into another home just to meet the family and see how they live. It was, I was told, 150 years old, but the windows had been added, and so had radios and TVs and overstuffed furniture. On the walls there was a picture of a soldier in uniform and another of Christ. Roman Catholicism and the religion of their ancestors, expressed, I gather, mostly in dances, lived quite contentedly side by side. And then, the most interesting experience of all, we went into the home studio workshop of Maria Montez and Popova Da. Many of the residents of San Ildefonso are pottery makers, but Maria Montez is an artist of renown, and her talent has passed on to her son, Popova Da. They had great dignity and presence. They showed me what the designs meant on their pottery, the feather of the eagle, the clouds, the mountains. She had revived an ancient process of their people in making black-on-black pottery, and has won international prizes in ceramic shows. As I walked through the village, children clustered around me, every step wanting autographs, taking pictures, giving me flowers, very much indeed like children anywhere. A delightful thing was that Lee Udall knew the first names of person after person. The type of pottery he or she made, was always asking questions about someone who had gone off to college. She really cares, and she knows. And then, after a little over an hour's stay, we were back in the cars. This time I rode with Tony and headed up into the Sangre de Cristo Mountains to see the golden aspens. This is really what I had yearned to come to Santa Fe for, and it had been a struggle to keep it in the schedule. As we wound up into the mountains, we could see great slopes of gold in magnificent contrast to the green of the ponderosa pine and Douglas fir, and finally when we got into a great grove of the aspens, it was magic to look out among their white trunks and up through the gold leaves to the blue sky. When the tiniest breeze blows, their leaves shiver like fairy castanets. We entered a national forest, and the forester, Mr. Lattimore, rode with us and told us about it, the logging operations, the leases to cattlemen for grazing, the work of foresters to keep down fires, and a check through the amount of snows and the water in the little streams to estimate how much water would be going down to the big rivers. Finally, at the appointed place, we stopped, and it was already occupied by some ladies in a station wagon, easels and pallets and paintbrushes, who were wandering off among the aspens looking for just the right place to set them up, and who, of course, were startled to see this caravan approach. We followed a little mountain stream up a trail for several blocks, Tony and I, for the benefit of the cameramen who were clicking away. We'd reached a height of about 10,000 feet by then. As we descended, we stopped again against a rock with a magnificent panoramic view of mountains behind us, great spreads of gold among the green. Three times we found artists painting along the road. And then, as we made our way back into Santa Fe, we had a bonus that I enjoyed quite as much as the aspen. All along the roadside were huge bushes of chamisa, its soft gold a perfect foil for the brilliant purple aster that very often grew in clumps close by. I made a note to write the head of the highway department in New Mexico to tell him what a marvelous combination and how much this would add to the pleasure of the tourist driving through New Mexico, and I hope they'd plan out a lot more. And I asked Tony if he could possibly get me some seed, particularly of the asters. We were at the plane by 12:30. It had been a full and delightful morning. And I always enjoy my times with Tony. And as we said goodbye, Martiana took off her sweater, a brilliant pink which I had admired, and gave it to me. We lunched on board the plane. There's always that exhilarated feeling as you wind up one of these trips. You're bone tired, but it's been a great trip. You try to give notes to a secretary about how to write the thank yous. You have a couple of interviews with newspaper women who want you to sum up your feelings or to know more about some facet of the trip. You thank the people who've advanced it and the people who've been with you. And then, this time, because I was getting off in Austin, I got on the loudspeaker and said goodbye to all of my fellow travelers with the hope that they'd had as good a time as I had. We lost an hour, so it was nearly 3 when we arrived at Austin, and Liz and Bob Knudsen and Tommy Atkins and I got on the King Air for the ranch, hearing the word as we did that Lyndon had arrived at the ranch with the Krims and the Walt Rostows just a few minutes before. Fortunately, I had given Bess over the phone early that morning a list of housing arrangements. The 4 Nugents in the Lewis house, the Krims in the Gay Room, and the Rostows and the Kentners in the Cedar House, Liz and Bess and Linda with us. So many strings to pull together. I arrived at the LBJ Ranch just 8 minutes before my guests were due, in a long-sleeved woolen dress and 90-degree temperature. And here I made a mistake. I went to the closet and pulled out a simple summer cotton, sleeveless, cool, and gratefully got into it and was out in the front yard only a minute behind my 3:30 guests. Some 250 women who had been hostesses at the Johnson City House, Lyndon's boyhood home, and at his birthplace here in Stonewall for the brief month that it was open this summer. And all the guests were in white gloves and high heels and new fall outfits. The party was sheer pandemonium. It took place in the front yard with 2 tables of delicious refreshments that I watched greedily Bess had seen to preparing them. Flowers were everywhere, arranged by Bess, and I stood on the steps and greeted each guest as Jesse Hunter introduced them. And then there was a picture, which made it a little stiff, but it will be a nice memento. Sometimes there was a hug or a kiss, Anita, a Mary Ellen, a pretty little Christy Posey, or an extra warm greeting. And then Lyndon came in. I'd seen him only one moment when I first arrived, and he rode off hungrily to have his first look at the fields. I thanked the ladies for their hours of interest and devotion that had made it possible for some 14,240 people from every state in the Union and 30 foreign countries to see the little house up the road where Lyndon was born during the month that it was open this summer. Betty Weinheimer said she had sweated out Idaho. She'd had 49 states up until the last day. And then finally, on that very last day, here came somebody from Idaho. And I thanked all the Blanco County women whose faithful stewardship had made possible a trip through Lyndon's boyhood home for more than 80,000 people from all over this country and more than 70 foreign countries in months that house had been opened. There was an interruption every 2 or 3 minutes, A most remarkable and happy one. First, when Lyndon came in, and I introduced him, and in a very warm and intimate way, he talked to them. And then in bounced Lucy, in a bright-colored shift, looking about 14, with Pat. And I introduced them, and she said a few words, and then began to mix in the crowd. And then in came Jerry and his wife, Phyllis, and I told everybody how happy we were that he was just back from Vietnam, safe, 3 days before, and was here spending the weekend with us. And then I even introduced Kim. John Connolly had come in with Lyndon. He'd flown down with him from Washington. I introduced him. I'm increasingly proud of him. He's so handsome and so able. He began on the warm note of, I know you do this because you're proud of your neighbor, your friend, the man that you or your mothers and fathers grew up with, and you're proud of your part of the country, and you want to show it to people from all over this land. And then he led into discussion of tourism, its increase in Texas, what it meant in the economy. I think the ladies must have been very pleased. The only thing is, how can I ever top it? Finally, I handed out the awards for those who had contributed the most hours, led by Mrs. Lena Johnson with 288 hours. Jesse Hunter and Betty Weinheimer made little talks about interesting vignettes in their experience of being a hostess, and they were very good. I've known Jesse's capacity for growth for some time. And Betty was polished, interesting, thoroughly delightful. Then I said to everybody, get another helping of refreshments and follow me out to the hangar, and let's see the preview of the movie of Pat's and Lucy's wedding. That is, if you don't have to go home to cook supper or take the children to the football game. Most of us trooped out and sat for a full hour. Later, I thought, this is no tea. It's a full afternoon. I cheered for Tommy Atkins, Bess and Liz and Simone and everybody, and especially Lucy and Pat. It was good. A bit long, though. It was sundown when we finished, and the guests left around 7, and Liz and Bess and I piled into a car and headed out just anywhere toward the fading sun. In the dance property, we met Lyndon driving with the top down, and I moved over beside him with that delicious feeling of release, of work done, of days of rest ahead, and a more congenial weekend it would be hard to imagine. It was after 9 when we sat down to dinner, with the Krims and the Morsons and the Rostows, and Wheezy, whom we'd asked to stay, Jake, Marie, and Vicky, and Simon, and Mary Slater, and Bess, and Liz. I caught up on the news of Lyndon. It had been a busy 4 days for him, too. He'd appointed Katzenbach, the number 2 spot in state, being vacated by George Ball, and brought in Gene Rostow for the number 3 spot, and Foy Cola for the 4th. He'd gone out to dinner each night, once to Mary Ellen and Mike Monroney's, to Florence Mahoney and the George Woods. How I would have loved that evening. And he'd rounded out 1,037 days as president, the length of time that President Kennedy served. They have put furrows in his brow and weariness in his heart, but all in all, it's been a great 1,000 days. And the only trouble with this trip was that there was not enough participation. I like to row and swim and walk, and wonderful as this was, it was all riding and looking and learning. Bess and Liz and all who worked on it are certainly due plaudits. And Lucy and Pat look as though they had invented happiness.